You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
We've got two brilliant authors here today. So we've got Beth Alison Barr, who's got her new book, Becoming the Pastor's Wife, How Marriage Replaced Ordination as a Woman's Path to Ministry. She's an amazing historian. Her book is a New York Times bestseller. It was described in the Publishers Weekly as a blistering critique of the narrowing options for female leadership in the evangelical church. So I'm sure we'll hear plenty about that. And she's in conversation with Chinny McDonald, who also has a book. Both of these books, by the way, are available to buy, and they will be doing a signing after this event. And Chinny's book is Unmaking Mary, Shattering the Myth of Perfect Motherhood, which has been described by Rowan Williams' former archbishop as deeply valuable. And Chinny is the vice chair of Greenbelt, and she's also the director of the think tank Theos. I'm sure this is going to be an amazing conversation, so I'll hand right over to them.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for coming. I have been really looking forward to this conversation, and it's going to be a conversation between the two of us. So I need to remember that I don't just have to ask the questions, I need to also talk. And one of the things I wanted to start with was explain to you a bit about my book, Unmaking Mary, Shattering the Myth of Perfect Motherhood. And I start the book at this particular moment in the middle of the night with my then kind of 6-month-old-ish baby, my second son. And for anyone who has had small children in the night, there are these really dark, I would say for me, some of the darkest moments of my life. The kind of torture of trying to get a baby to go back to sleep. And I had this moment where I was kind of, it was 3 a.m, there's no room around. Psychologically, it was tortuous. I felt out of control, crazy. And I remember picking my baby up and shouting at him. And then when I bundled him into the car at 3 a.m, we drove, did the only thing I could think that could work was drove round a roundabout to get him to sleep. I remember thinking, this is not what I thought motherhood would be like. I think I thought I might be good at motherhood. I think I thought it would be easy. I think I thought it would be flat and boring. But what I had experienced with having my children was this kind of range, texture of wild feelings and emotions and thoughts about what it was to be human, about God, about myself. And I realized that I didn't conform to an idea of what I thought motherhood would be like in my head. And as I started to think about what that was, I pictured Mary and the images of Mary, the mother of Jesus, as this archetype of perfect motherhood. And I thought about the way that she has been depicted, the postures that she's often seen in, her skin color, apparently, in lots of kind of European art over centuries. And I realized that I did not conform to that. And I think for many mothers, there is this sense of feeling not like we don't fit into this certain archetype, these myths. So I wrote the book. It's got lots of different kind of themes that we'll explore. But when it came to asking someone to write the foreword for my book, my number one pick for who could write the foreword for my book in the whole world was Professor Beth Alison Barr. And the reason for that is because particularly her book, The Making of Biblical Womanhood, opened my eyes again to these ideas about women that had been shaped over many centuries and how we'd arrived at, particularly in the conservative evangelicalism that I'd grown up in, at these ideas about women. So I wrote to Beth and she said yes. And it's a stunning foreword that I remember receiving and just kind of crying because she really got what I was trying to say. So Beth, I want to talk, particularly, let's start with The Making of Biblical Womanhood. Tell us what that's about and what we mean by biblical womanhood.
Absolutely. And thank you for coming and seeing somebody from Texas. You know, right now, I would imagine that's not the proudest place for me to say I'm from. But nonetheless, it's a nice respite here in the UK for a little bit. And the making of biblical womanhood in many ways is connected to Chinne's book on Unmaking Mary. It's just sort of taking it back to a bigger picture. Like, what are these ideas that the church, especially the evangelical church, has presented as the way to be as a Christian woman? And this concept of biblical womanhood, I actually gave it, I think, my favorite definition in Becoming the Pastor's Wife. You know, the nice thing about writing two books that are similar is that you have a lot of time to think. And so the way I would define biblical womanhood now is, number one, it is born in white North American evangelicalism. Okay, that is where it is born. And it is simply using the Bible to justify female subjugation. And that is what this complementarian theology is, that biblical womanhood is a part of, in fact, a significant part of, because complementarianism is the idea that women belong under, divinely created by God, to be underneath male authority.
Yeah. And you're a medieval historian. You're not a theologian. And I wonder where in the kind of medieval history, from then to now, how have we arrived at some of these ideas, and what are the kind of dominant ideas about women that come from the Bible?
Absolutely. So one of the beauties of being a medieval historian is that you do have a long view of what history looks like. And one of the things that I found is that even though there is continuity in how women are perceived, for example, we are always associated with giving birth and being mothers, because that is what women have done throughout history. But yet at the same time, there also are significant shifts. And really, all the way up through the early modern world, women were able to move into leadership positions in the church with support of men. And it wasn't until the very modern era, and I'm a medieval historian, so, you know, really, really modern era, till the late 19th and the 20th century, that we begin to see a theology articulate that women are never supposed to be in these types of positions. So very, very new idea. And with this new articulation of that women should never be in leadership, we also see a hardening idea that women's place is in the home, and that women's place, in some ways, in even conservative evangelical circles, that women's place is not in the workforce, that it is actually at home having children. And I have to say, this is do y'all know who Doug Wilson is? Does anybody here? No, anyway, unfortunately, I just told Chinne this beforehand, and she, anyway, had the appropriate response. But he recently gave an interview on CNN, which is a big U.S. Major news source. Here he was interviewed about his beliefs about women and men, and he teaches an extremely severe form of complementarianism and argues that women should never be pastors, never be in leadership, and that women's primary occupation is the home. And when he was asked what he thought women's roles, how God created women, he said that women are people who people come out of. And which is a horrific, I mean, if you think about that. And it also, I think, is very much the way that it portrays even motherhood, and reducing the idea of motherhood to even just this biological production that not all women are able to do, if we think about infertility. So I think this is an example to show how this concept of biblical womanhood within complementarian theology has also created these very rigid models of what women who are able to be and choose to be mothers are supposed to be.
And the fascinating thing about that, though, is that there is one woman who God came out of,
yes,
who is described as Theotokos, Mother of God. And for me as a Christian, I've kind of fallen in love with that idea again, that realization that God, in our Christian tradition, would choose to be born of a woman. It is radical, particularly at the times in which these ideas were written. And so for me, the kind of, I find it fascinating that the Mother of God has been reduced to this very tender, calm woman who's often got her head to the side. She's gazing at her baby. She is kind of reduced to this idea of just a mother. And when you think about the Reformation, there are all sorts of different ways in which Mary is portrayed. So at certain points in history, she is portrayed as the Queen of Heaven, like this kind of regal, adorned in gold and jewels character. And then we get to the Reformation, where what becomes important is the home, the fact that she is the helper to Joseph. She is kind of, she's a domestic goddess. She can clean and she can cook, and she's primarily in the home. And for me, that's like fascinating because we see the ways in which these ideas have been shaped and reshaped and made and unmade, depending on what the patriarchy wants to say about who women should be. What are your thoughts on Mary, particularly as a figure within these conversations?
So one of the things that I really loved about Sheena's book, hers was one of the easiest book that I said yes to for writing a forward to. It's just really fantastic. And one of the things I loved about it is that she does do a robust history, sort of like how does the image of Mary change over time? And as a medieval historian, I have a little bit of a leg up, I think, on some of way Mary has been portrayed. And the modern image of the way that we see Mary, and I kind of think I'm... So in the evangelical world that I grew up in, when we do our Christmas plays, one of the famous songs that became associated that churches would sing all the time is Mary, Did You Know? Do y'all know that song? Mary, Did You Know? Okay. You know, which is a highly irritating song because Mary gave the Magnificat. I mean, it's just, yes, of course, Mary knew her child was the Son of God. She knew he was coming to change the world. But yet we have reduced her in these white evangelical churches that I grew up in to the being really, I mean, this teenage mom is the way that she is often portrayed. This teenage mom who is quiet and still and subordinate. And as a medievalist, this is a really shocking image to me because how many of y'all go to the V&A? Have you been to the V&A in a while? I love the V&A in London. Okay. And I was actually just there. I was looking at images of Mary. And one of my favorite images of Mary, and it's really great. It's in the medieval and Renaissance rooms where they have all of the standalone statues that are out. And if you look up on the wall, there is this fantastic, very large carving of Mary. And she's like carrying the ultimate, like, you know, child wrap system where she has Jesus like in the front of her chest and her arms are out like this. And she is protecting. There's this entire town that is standing underneath her arms. And it's one of the images of Mary as the defender and Mary as the protector. And this idea, and then of course, also some of the favorite images of Mary. Have y'all seen her holding the bat and beating Satan? Y'all seen those? Okay, Google Mary beats Satan, okay? Just Google that. And you're going to come up with all these astonishing medieval images of like Mary with the bat, Mary with the baton. Anyway, and this idea that she, and it comes, of course, from Genesis, where it says, you know, that that the woman will crush the head of the serpents. And in the medieval world, it's this idea of this image of Mary, who is actually not only the defender of the faith, but she is actively, you know, going to war against Satan to protect people from it. And then by the time we get to the post-Reformation world, we begin to see this transformation of Mary into this very docile, and as you also point out in the book, mostly white woman, which is a shift. So do you want to pick it up there and talk about?
Newsflash, Mary wasn't white. She definitely wasn't white. She probably had brown skin. In fact, it wasn't just Mary and it wasn't just Jesus, but there are hardly any white people in the Bible. They're not from these parts. And yet even I When I think of Mary, my first image is white Mary. When I think of Jesus, my first image is white Jesus. And it's only when you stop and step back and think about it, you realize that there's been a lot of propaganda that has been put into creating these images that are so pervasive in our culture and in our theology. As I was writing the book in the kind of years when I became a mother, I've been a mother for seven years, I've devoured motherhood books, particularly from secular writers. And one of the things that I noticed in a lot of these secular books, so Adrian Rich's Of Woman Born, Lucy Jones' Matrescence, all of these books about the maternal condition, maternal anxieties, from these secular perspectives, every single one of them at some point mentioned Mary. So Mary is an interesting person in that she is one of the very few things that kind of crosses the kind of sacred secular divide in kind of popular culture. There's these ideas about who she is. And what people would always often say in these secular books was that she represented a container, a vessel, a prop, a dummy, that she was flat, and that she was also oppressive, used to oppress women and used to oppress mothers with these kind of ideas and these myths about what we should be. But for me, one of the dominant myths about Mary is this kind of, is this white Mary. And I, in the book, I've got a chapter called Black Madonna, which is, for those who don't know, Black Madonnas are kind of black representations of Mary. And there are lots of debates about whether they are deliberately black or just accidentally black, made out of black material. But regardless, what I think that they have come to represent, particularly in many justice movements, is the this kind of representation of the marginalized group, whatever that marginalized group is. Last year, I made a documentary for BBC World Service on Black Madonnas, and I went to Paris with Christina Cleveland, who wrote a book called God is a Black Woman. And I didn't think that it mattered to me that much, the race in which Mary was represented. But we went to this small chapel just outside Paris, and I walked into the small chapel and there was a black Madonna at the front. And I found it viscerally, extraordinarily moving, because she was the centerpiece of this chapel. She was the person that people were coming from all over the world to see. People's eyes were fixed on her. And she looked a little bit like me or my mum or my aunties. And I realized that it did matter to me that I hadn't seen that representation of myself. So one of the things that I think has drawn me to your work, particularly in this moment, is the, I guess, the alignment of these ideas about women with ideas about whiteness.
Yes.
And particularly American evangelicalism, nationalism. How are you at the moment with all of that, where you are?
It is surreal being in the U.S. right now. I have to say it is surreal being in Texas. You know, while I've been over here, Texas has voted to gerrymander our districts to make it where people of color's votes count less than white people's. Yes, this just happened. And even in thinking about issues of women, like, for example, another thing, our Secretary of Defense, whose name is Peter Hegseth, and I really hope you don't know his name, but nonetheless, his name is Peter Hegseth, and he is actually a member of Doug Wilson's church. And he put out on social media a video of the pastors in his church talking about that they would support repealing the 19th Amendment, which in the U.S. is what gives women the right to vote. And this is, and you know, in some ways, this is just, it's just surreal. And it also, though, helps connect the dots for me between when we have ideas about women, theological ideas about women, in which we teach that women are worth less than men, and that women's identity is boiled down to people who people come out of. And we don't think that has real implications for then how women are treated in our broader society and in our political world, and not, I mean, not just even in our churches, but in the workplace. You know, this complementarian theology, theology that teaches women are less than men, never stays confined to our houses and our churches. It spills out. And one of the reasons why there is still so much sexism and difficulties and obstacles for women in the workplace and in churches is because we have not rooted out this idea that women are divinely created by God to be in a subservient position that is connected to their role as mother.
Yeah. It's the most depressing of times. It feels like things are going backwards.
Yes.
And one of the things that I'm kind of obsessed with, this kind of these ideas about nationalism and particularly the Trump era, watching from across the pond, and also seeing those ideas over here. Yes. And increasing, and they're kind of rapidly, mm-hmm. they're here. This kind of rise of the far right and these ideas about women, about people of different races, these are all intertwined. But one of the really sinister places that I see this play out, particularly on social media, is in trad wives. So for those who aren't always on Instagram like me, trad wives are very much a social media phenomenon. And they are women who pretend to hark back to a golden age of family and a golden age for women that probably never existed. But these are women who have beautiful homes. They wear long, flowy dresses. They milk their own cows. They make their own jam. They've got 9 children. They don't work.
They homeschool.
They are the perfect ideal. Well, they're putting forward these ideals about what it is to be a woman, what it is to be a mother. And what is really sinister for me is this propaganda is being put forward by women who are married to millionaires or billionaires. They've got this whole kind of financial backing behind them. They are not really kind of just, you know, making their own jam and kind of living this kind of very simple life. They are putting forward these ideas. And ultimately what that is linked to, I think, is this kind of pronatalist idea that is held by people like J.D. Vance, the vice president of the US, and Pete Hegseth, and all these people, where there is this idea about women's role, white women's role, is to make more white babies so that our nation can be more white and so that we can breed more than the Muslims, right? That's basically what it was boiling down to. It's about racism, it's about white supremacy, and it's about money and power. Do you agree?
100%. I agree. You know, and in fact, I can say, having been in the archives working on the Southern Baptist Convention, which I'm not sure how aware you are of the Southern Baptist Convention, but it is the largest Protestant denomination in the U.S. It has over 13 million people. Used to have more than 15 million people. It is gradually getting smaller, which I'm all for. If you don't know much about Baptists in the U.S., the Southern Baptist Convention was born over before the Civil War, and it was the group of Baptists who decided that slavery was biblical. And that is what the Southern Baptist Convention was born in. They did not apologize for this for 150 years. Mm. So it was actually in the 1990s that they finally apologized for the racist origins of the Southern Baptist Convention. And their archives clearly show that this concern about women's roles in the church and the emergence of these ideas of that, you know, again, biblical womanhood, complementarian theology, that they are born directly in the changing post-World War II era in the U.S., where there is significant concern about jobs and immigrants and women in the workforce. And so these ideas begin to simmer that women and belong in jobs that don't take jobs away from white men, and which, you know, also reduces them to the household. And that also that white men's jobs are being threatened by people who are non-white. And these ideas together all kind of worked to help create the emergence of this new theology that is going to burst forth and with a vengeance in 1986. Y'all, that is so recent. I know I'm older than people in the room here, but 1986 is really recent. And 1986 is when Christianity Today, 1986, 1987 is when they published the Danvers Statement. And the Danvers Statement is the articulation of this theology that women belong completely underneath male authority and should not be pastors. And that is really, really late in the historical game. And it is directly connected to these ideas about Christian nationalism, as well as the entrenchment of racism in the white church.
I wonder if you can tell us a bit about just what it's been like for you the past few years, as someone who's been quite vocal because of what you've written and what you say, within and without the kind of the Southern Baptists. Has it been like for you behind the scenes?
Yeah. So the Gospel Coalition does not like me. If y'all don't know who they are, John Piper, et cetera. The Southern Baptist Convention does not like me. let's just put that out there too. It's been extremely challenging. You know, I tell people that when I wrote The Making of Biblical Womanhood, I'm a medieval historian. You don't get into medieval history because you want to be in the spotlight. especially not, my expertise is medieval sermons. I read 15th century sermons. I mean, seriously, do y'all want to read a book about, I think it's very exciting. But nonetheless, that's my specialty. And so that's not a field you really get into expecting to be out in the spotlight or to write anything that might have as much influence as The Making of Biblical Womanhood has. And the reason I wrote The Making of Biblical Womanhood, and I tell my story in the book, my husband and I were in a church that was becoming increasingly complementarian, where women were being pushed out of spaces that they had once been allowed to, even in that church. And I had been on a journey for quite a long time, simply because I'm a historian. And one of the things about history is that it is that you learn about how theology evolves. And you learn about ideas and that they have a historical context. And I had begun to realize that this concept of biblical womanhood that I'd been being taught for a very long time actually was not rooted in the Bible. That's my thesis of The Making of Biblical Womanhood. It's the shortest thesis ever, that biblical womanhood isn't biblical. And that's pretty much it. And so when I was approached, my husband was fired from this church we were at when he tried to get a woman to teach high school Sunday school. And in the U.S., high school is essentially 13 through 17, 18. And the idea is that because in the Jewish tradition that boys become men at the age of 12 or 13. I don't know how many of you have a 12-year-old boy. I've had a 12-year-old boy, but nonetheless, that they become men. And so women, therefore, are not able to teach them at that age. And my husband and I challenged that, and he was fired. Within 3 weeks of that, he actually lost his job. And so when I was approached to write The Making of Biblical Womanhood, my thought was, I was like, you know, it won't hurt. It was like, I might as well give it a shot. I got paid a very small amount for it. And my thought was, at the very least, I can put braces on my son, was sort of the thought with The Making of Biblical Womanhood. And so it was really a last ditch effort to try to get people to wake up in the white evangelical church, to wake up to this idea that teaching that women belong under male authority is not actually a Christian idea. It's not actually a biblical idea. Patriarchy is in the Bible, but that doesn't make patriarchy Christian. It is something that is born in human culture that then has been absorbed and seeps into the church. And it is always connected to racism. And it is always about controlling women's bodies is always part of this, which is very much this idea when we think about this image of what women have been reduced to with modern motherhood.
Oh, damn. So, so I guess this is part of why this is this whole conversation, the place that we are currently in history and in culture is so infuriating is because of the alignment of these ideas with Christianity that is not biblical. And one of the things that I've realised is that theology does actually really matter. So I was part, for many years, I was part of a complementarian church, but was never a complementarian myself. So would kind of just disagree and then be given books by John Piper and Wade Grudem, that kind of thing, to try and convince me of why I was wrong. But it wasn't just the fact that women weren't allowed to preach or be the elders of the church, but it was the effects of that on all of the women around me in the church that I was part of, women I loved, many women who had successful careers until the point at which they got married and became mothers. And therefore, the assumption was that they would give that up so that they would only be in the home to raise their children. I saw the effects on them of that. And one of the things that I find so troubling about these ideas, particularly about trad wives, is this presentation of motherhood as, first of all, the ultimate goal for a woman, and also that motherhood is perfect, like the perfection, the kind of shininess, the sparkle. And for many mothers and for many women, whether or not they have children or not, whether they want children or not, there is a lot of pain behind the scenes. There is postnatal depression, trauma, infertility, pregnancy loss, death. All of these things are not shiny. They don't fit on a kind of a trad wife Instagram post. And so for me as a Christian, these ideas about people getting married, having children, therefore having it all together is really troubling. And even though I have kind of critique this kind of cultural Mary that has been put out into our society. Mary herself, if you actually read the Bible, is a powerful woman, is the mother of God. And what I was really fascinated to find out in the research for the book was that there is lots of there are lots of kind of historical documents and images of Mary, not in this pose, but in this pose, like as a leader in the Jesus movement, as very much there, very much present, very much a powerful woman, the Magnificat Mary, who is depicted in our culture without a baby, you know, before the baby arrives, as this kind of this person who speaks with this prophetic voice, who wants to turn the world right way up. But also, one of the dominant images of Mary we see is the Pietà Mary, who is cradling the dead body of her son, having watched Jesus die on the cross, her child. And the pain of that for me has become even more poignant as I think about all of these women, all these people who have gone through this tragedy, oppression, pain, trauma. One of the things that I loved was that Toni Morrison converted to Catholicism, and a lot of kind of black activists, black writers have found in Mary something beautiful, and in the Black Madonna, but in Mary in particular, because in Catholicism, there is this understanding of Mary as someone who did not, and women in the Bible, who did not turn away from the pain and the trauma, who were alongside the broken bodies, who were the people that cared and nurtured, and who were also powerful. So I want us to kind of recapture and remake that Mary rather than the Mary that is the kind of first Mary that comes to mind.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the reasons why Mary is seen as so dangerous to evangelical theology. And I don't know, those of you who may have grown up in traditions where there was almost a fear of any sort of like images of Mary or focusing on her too much, talking about her too much, because we don't worship Mary. That's what, you know, medieval Catholics did. And that's not part of what we only worship God. And, you know, the thing that they miss about medieval Catholicism is that in medieval Catholicism, Mary always points to Jesus. It isn't about her so much. It's about her pointing towards the Son of God. And it is also about, you know, this is one of the things I love about the medieval Mary, is that the way that she was known was she was the first person who believed. She, as you know, if we think about the beginning of the Christian era, they saw her as the woman who, you know, not was raped by a God, which in many ways is the way that some even systematic theology, the way they present Mary as being this passive recipient of the, and the only time women are passive in the sexual act is rape. And so that's a very problematic image. And in the medieval world, the way that Mary is seen is that she believes that God is bringing the Savior to humanity, and she accepts, she believes, she's the active partner in that. And because of that, she is an active participant. And I recently, you know, you always see new things, even as somebody who's been a historian for as long as I have. And when I was at the V&A just the other day, for the first time, I realized that, you know, they have all these wonderful displays of croziers. And croziers, of course, are the bishop, are the, I have to explain this to Americans more than I have to explain it to y'all, but you know that they are the symbols of authority that bishops carry. And if you go and look at those croziers in the V&A, those medieval croziers, do you know who is in the center of the that shepherd's hook that symbolizes the authority of the bishop?
Doug Wilson.
It's not Doug Wilson. No, it is Mary. It is Mary, which is, you know, I mean, I think about this that, you know, people often think about the medieval world. They say, oh, well, women couldn't be priests in the medieval world. And I'm y'all, that narrative is not that simple. There have actually been significant women in leadership in the medieval world is a constant part of that story. And it is only in the modern world, in the modern U.S. and spilling over into the rest of the world, that we have completely shut women out of leadership positions. This is a new theology. That is the first time. You can take that from a church historian. But I could imagine that in the medieval world, even as these bishops who were a symbol, you know, had their symbols of authority, they were remembering the faith and the power of a woman's faith symbolized in their symbols of authority. And I was like, you know, this is why Mary is dangerous, because if we actually read her words of the Magnificat and we actually realize who she is, we realize, and I think you said this so beautifully in Unmaking Mary, where, you know, God chose to have a mother. And to me, I think that is a most powerful statement, that God sees women as fully created in his image.
And I think part of the reduction of Mary to this kind of one-dimensional figure is comes from the particular readings of where she appears in the Bible. So it's almost like she's, you know, there as pregnant Mary, then she gives birth, and then at the end she's there. Maybe we'll talk about bodies in a minute. But one of the things, Rowan Williams does this amazing talk at St. Paul's Cathedral a couple of years ago, and he reminded me that Mary is there throughout, and that Mary was Jesus's first teacher. So who do you think taught Jesus about how the world should be? Who do you think taught him about scripture? Who do you think was there? She was the one who was very much teaching him too. It wasn't just that she was kind of gave birth to this baby who then became God and told her how it should be. She was very much present. And I think that's one of the things that we miss in this kind of reduction of Mary's this vessel who gave birth to Jesus.
So y'all have an advantage that I don't have in the U.S. I can't walk into churches that are 1,000 years old or see images from the medieval world on their walls. And so next time you walk into these churches and you see these spaces and you see images of Mary, especially at the Annunciation, I want you to look, because she is always holding a book. I don't know if you've noticed that before. She's holding a book. And this book is what medieval people believe, as the Gospels say, that this, that Mary pondered all the things in her heart. This is her book, that she's pondering all of those things in her heart. And you think about, like, where did people learn about the nativity story, none of the gospel writers were there. Mary taught it to them. And so for people who come to me and say, well, you know, men didn't, there's no women who wrote a book of the Bible. And I'm like, well, it may have come through the pen of a man, but let me tell you, the words of a woman was told about that birth story of who Jesus was. And that, anyway, yes.
Although I would say that if a woman had been holding the pen, the stories might have been a bit different. And that's one of the last kind of conversation we'll have before we open it up is there's a chapter in my book called This Is My Body Broken For You. And it is about the reality and the physicality of motherhood, but also infertility, pregnancy loss, these really dark and painful things that people go through. But there is this tradition within Catholicism kind of that Jesus' birth was kind of very
painless.
That 1 minute the baby was in Mary's tummy, then Joseph looked away and there was a flash of light and Jesus was out. And this idea that pain, that Mary couldn't have had pain because pain is only reserved for sinful women. It's for sin, and it's the association of women with sin. And we haven't touched on Eve, we've mainly talked about Mary, but these ideas about women's bodies are also there in these kind of traditions and how we've arrived at these ideas.
Yes. Yeah. No, and I, you know, that is, some of the medieval stories about the birth of Jesus really are quite that funny. Like one of them where Mary's literally just standing against the wall and suddenly Jesus like appears. And, you know, as we know. And so at this understanding, I think this is one of the ways that this idea for women, you know, this idea that birth is supposed to be beautiful. And it's something that as you go through it, you know, it's the most, you know, I think about all of the people who want to do home births and stuff like that now. And I have two kids and neither me or my son would have survived his birth if I hadn't been in a hospital. And then my daughter was breached and also had to be taken by C-section and was in the NICU for several days, which is the intensive care unit. And so, you know, for me, I'm thinking about, you know, birth is actually hard and it's traumatic on the body. And this is something that I think that we often kind of glaze over, even in the church, because we're like, God created women to have kids. So therefore, this is a beautiful experience. Mm-hmm. And the fact is that this is a hard world. And it's giving birth is one of the hardest things I think anyone does.
Yeah. Right. Thank you. Let's open it up to questions. I think we've got two roving mics, so put your hand up if you'd like to ask. We've got some questions at the hands at the back here.
Firstly, a reminder that this talk is being recorded, so your lovely voices will be on the recording, and this is a question and answer, not a statement and answer. So if you have a statement, put a question mark on the end of it or up speak in the end. I'm not sure. Let's go
back here.
Hi. As you've said, this modern idea of quote unquote biblical womanhood is a very new thing. What do you what stories can we take from the Bible? What would a actual biblical woman be, in your opinion? Like, what stories should we take from, and such and such?
You know, I think that's the beauty of actual biblical womanhood in the Bible is that women do everything in the Bible. Women are, you know, that they are part of all of the stories, and their stories are always different. We do meet mothers in the Bible, but we also meet church leaders, and we meet people like Miriam, who again is another authoritative prophetic singer voice that we have. We also have women like Hagar. Hagar is one of my favorite stories in the Bible. She is the first person who names God. And she names God, you know, she is this, essentially she is this enslaved, brown woman who has been treated horrifically by both Abram and Sarai. And she is, when she runs out into the desert, I mean, like, who cares about her? She is this cast off person, and it is to her that God comes, and she names him the God who sees. And that to me is just, you know, so, I think, to think that the very first person who names God in the Bible is a woman, and she names him the God who sees me, who sees a woman like me. And we see that narrative continued throughout the Bible. And one of the, you know, I always tell my students when we think about, and I haven't talked much about the pastor's wife, but my argument for the pastor's wife is that it actually has become one of the ways that biblical womanhood has been taught to the church. And I've been a pastor's wife for 28 years, and I still am. So I can talk about that. But nonetheless, but this, I think what we see, the pastor's wife, like the idea of Mary, has reduced woman to sort of one thing, to one type of ministry. And this is simply not what we see in the Bible. We see women doing every type of ministry. Just go read Romans 16. So I'll stop there. I'll let you add.
Okay, what she said. I think I'd say that biblical womanhood is just humanity. It is in the range of stories and the places in which women appear. And if you think about it, they are in surprising places, considering the context and the history, the historical times in which these stories were coming about. So I think it is kind of because of the kind of modern, well, because of the patriarchy over the past few centuries, that we have this false reading and perception. So it means that when I go to the Bible, I am surprised by the women that I find there. But actually, that's the kind of the source of some of these ideas. So I think it's in the range of humanity.
Hi, I have been a pastor's wife, and I'm a Methodist local preacher. So this is really fascinating, and you could probably talk for another hour on those topics. But my question is quite short, which is... it's also concerning, everything that we hear, everything that you've spoken about. So where do we go from here? What do we do about this? Because at the moment, I'm feeling a bit depressed.
Yeah.
Hope in the making. You know,
yeah, imagine being a pastor's wife in Texas right now. So it's really easy to, I think, get depressed. But the theme here is hope in the making. And as a historian, I can say this. I think history gives me hope. It gives me hope for women in the church, because while on the one hand, there have always been people who have said that women do not belong in leadership, that women should look a certain way and that women should be a certain way, and have always tried to limit and police women's bodies, there have always been people who have pushed against that. And there have always been women who have stepped into the calling that God gave them with courage and have stood against male voices, and that there have always been men who support them. You know, this is one of the things I say, is that we're often told, we're like, oh, well, you know, Timothy, 1 Timothy 2 says that women should be silent and should not teach or have authority over men. And I'm like, well, yeah, that's there. But that's not the only thing that's there. We see women teaching and holding authority over men. And so I think that we can't just look, as tempting as it is to just look at the bad. And as I said, I'm speaking here from my place. It's easy to get lost in how the world seems to be going backwards and not making any progress. But if you look at the broad sweep of history, what we see is that God has always called and used women, and that women have always stepped into that calling and been supported in that calling. And so I think, you know, that can give us hope, that maybe one day we can actually move where this is more common.
Yeah. I think maybe also some of the hopelessness for me, I find, comes when I'm going big, when I'm basically watching CNN or reading about Trump and thinking, I've got to stop that guy. How can I stop him? And how reading about how horrific everything is. But I think I find hope in looking around me, in looking around this room, in looking at my own church, in looking around at the amazing women who you could not tell me that they are subordinate to men. They don't believe it. They don't act like it. We just don't do that. So I think we just have to kind of find the hope around us and kind of look smaller rather than bigger.
Let me just say I'm totally supportive of what you're both saying, but I just wondered how you view the headship passages in the New Testament.
You made me take all of them first. I mean, I'll do it, but okay, do you want to... So again, I'll go back to what I just said, that those headship passages are there. But at the same time, they are not the only thing that is there, that we see. So if, for example, if women aren't to preach or hold authority over men, then what do we do with Priscilla? And you know, this is one of the reasons why there's so much controversy about how Priscilla is interpreted and people like Junia are interpreted. Because the fact is that what those passages show is they show a woman teaching and holding authority over men and being given the same titles as men, like deacon and apostle. And so if that is true, then how do we say that 1 Corinthians 2 is a statement? This is actually what's bizarre about that passage, y'all, is that for some reason, we have taken that passage and said that this applies to all women for all times in all spaces. And that is not logical. That is absolutely bizarre. Where else do we do that with certain things like head coverings and with other statements? I mean, are y'all still, you know, not boiling lambs in the milk of their own, their mothers? You know, if you remember some of those, I mean, why did we do this with what's one particular passage? And what do I think about 1 Timothy 2? I think that Paul was telling some women in a particular place for contextual reasons to sit down and learn before they teach. And so he is telling women to sit down and shut up, but that doesn't mean that he's telling all women in all places in all times to sit down and shut up. And there's a big difference there.
Let's take another.
I have a question here. Thank you so much. I found what this forum very interesting, especially when you said that some of the aspects or attributes of women that we get from the Bible are just mere cultural things that happened at that time, and we do not have an obligation to follow it. And I was happy also to hear of the Catholic version of Mary. I come from that background. But as someone who works with many churches at the moment here, coming from an African background, where when we were talking about getting the Bible to our people, we talked about enculturation. And now you spoke about culture being also something that can block us. How can we deculture the Bible so that we can have the ideal image of maybe of a Christian or the ideal places of women or whoever in the church? Can we remove culture completely? Is it possible? How can we have Christ come to us in an equal manner without looking down upon any person or gender?
It's a beautiful question.
Okay, you go first.
I have a real short answer for you. One of the problems with our interpretations and our how we have let so much culture and harmful culture creep into what we believe are biblical teachings is because we are only reading versions of the Bible that are translated and produced by a very small group of white men. Have y'all thought about that? So for example, one of the most horrific moments for, I told Sheena this earlier. Did I tell you this one earlier about the, anyway, I told somebody this earlier, was when I was, it was several years ago when I was in London and I was at St. Helen's Bishopgate, which is a beautiful church. I love St. Helen's Bishopgate. It's one of the only medieval churches that still has the double nave for nuns. It was a group of nuns was attached to it, a convent. And so I went there and I was taking a picture of the double nave to show my students what it looked like. And I looked down in the chairs and all of the chairs are filled with English Standard versions of the Bible, the ESV. The ESV is the most quickly, rapidly spreading Bible translation in the U.S. and globally. It is also produced by complementarian theologians for the express purpose of teaching complementarian theology. And so they have changed things specific things in the Bible to make it look like women were never in leadership positions and that women always belong under male headship. And so one of the ways that we can counter this, I think, is by reading different versions of the Bible that are translated by different people. And I'm not saying that the Bible, you know, as I said, I fully believe in the Bible as the word of God. But the reality is that as we have translated it, we have changed subtle meanings of things, such as the headship passages about women, and those differences matter. And so if we can read a larger variety of translations of the Bible, I think that would help.
I would just add that one of the things that I find most beautiful about the Christian tradition is the idea of incarnation, that it is contextual, that you can't just transport a Bible to a context and think that it means the same as what it did when it was written. We're supposed to read it and think about what it means for us today. So that obviously means that in different cultures and at different times, different politics, we read and see things differently and we interpret things differently. So one of the really, obviously you can never separate theology from culture, but that is also part of the beauty of theology, is the contextualization. And one of the problems is in translation. So I would encourage people to read different translations. I'd encourage people to read things like Womanist Midrash by Wilda Gaffney, who has a kind of black feminist, womanist reading of the scriptures that we've come to kind of lazily understand as meaning certain things. I think it's really important for us to keep rethinking what the Bible means for us today in our place.
Thank you. I've seen loads of hands up, which is absolutely incredible. We will only have time in this session to have two more questions, but please continue to fostering your curiosity around the festival, the Green Belt. Thank you.
Hello. Thank you so much. It's a beautiful conversation. I want to ask you both, how do you pray, invoke Mary, or the right relationship with the feminine, with the mother? How do you do that? Do you do that?
So for me, over the past few years, from my last book, God Is Not a White Man, to Unmaking Mary, I pray completely differently, or I talk about God in different ways, and I picture God and I imagine God in different ways. So sometimes I will talk to God as mother, and for me, as an evangelically raised woman, that felt really scary to me a few years ago. But it is in the Bible itself. Like, you know, the ways in which God is described is not just in male ways. It is also in feminine ways. These ideas of the divine feminine, of God as mother, unlock something for me about who God is. So for me, the way that things have changed is in how I conceive of God, how I understand God. And I think it's really important for all of us to try and break God out of the boxes in which God might have been placed because of the theologies that we might have been brought up in. So one of the things I find most helpful is, I think back to a few years ago when I did a talk at a primary school, and I asked them to describe to me what God was like. And I thought that they would say Father Christmas and, you know, hippies and whatever. But they said things like, God looks like a ball of energy. God looks like a yin-yang sign. God looks like a ghost with glasses. Like, it was just kind of completely like not, like, it really helps me to just think of God in different ways. And that's how I'm doing it.
So I'm Baptist. I still am Baptist. I'm not Southern Baptist, but I am Baptist still. So this may sound a little odd, but I'm also a medieval historian, and I am privileged to read the words of prayer of people in manuscripts that date from, you know, the 12th and the 13th and the 15th century. And I have often found that I use those prayers. I use those prayers of people who came before me. Like, one of my favorite prayers is by Marjorie Kemp. I don't know if y'all know Marjorie Kemp. She was a wild woman, but she was a woman of God. And one of her prayers is, Lord, you have brought us to this place for love of you. be with us and help us. And I don't know how many times I pray that prayer in the US. And so I think using prayer language from people who have come before us, especially in different traditions, can be really helpful. And of course, one of the things in the medieval world is that speaking of God as mother is very common. And in fact, you know, Julian of Norwich, who probably you all know too. I mean, that's, and it's not just Julian of, it's not just women who talk about God as mother. It was actually a phenomenon among male clergy who spoke as God as mother in some of the most beautiful writings. And so I think about expanding our worldview can really help us to think about how big God is. Yeah. I find history helpful.
Thank you. So have we got time for one more question?
Yeah. And now on the last question, please, can we keep the answers brief?
Oh.
Hi, I'm from Ireland, so I just actually wanted to give a message of actually hope. And when my mother got married in 1970, the only thing in Ireland was a trad wife. We had a marriage ban that when you got married in Ireland in 1970, you had to give up work. But there was one fatal mistake. The one job that people could do was be a teacher. And today, Ireland has one of the most liberal countries in the world. We've gone from when there was compulsory trad wives to a very open, inclusive society. And that has, I think, been born on people like my mother who were unbelievably frustrated having to give a date of end on the date she got engaged and also banning pretty much homeschooling because it meant you had to go and be in the village. So I suppose when we look at the danger of trad wives and what it, we don't want people to embrace that. But when trad wives become forced and people having to choose to be at home, that has ended in one generation becoming a very, very inclusive liberal country. So there is a hope there that actually people can choose to be different from that. And I think just from people saying it was depressing, it can actually be the start of a small revolution.
Thank you. I think
that's a good word of hope.
That's a great place to end.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.